long have we known each other? 17?
I think we've probably known each other for, probably 17 years, I think.
Yeah, wow, crazy.
Yeah.
And so we went to BU together, and you were in the sketch group Slow Kids at Play. And now, and then for many years, I don't know if you still, do you still write for Jimmy Fallon or?
No, I was a writer there from 2012 to 2016. And then I left to go try to do a work on a pilot for Comedy Central that did not end up getting picked up. Then I went back to The Tonight Show and was a sketch supervising writer from the end of 2016 to August of 2019. So I left the show about a little over a year ago, 15 months ago, maybe.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
And that was, so that was before coronavirus. So, I want to like dive into everything about, you know, working there, and I have a million questions, but I guess,
I want to mention though, right at the outset, because I think this is worth saying that, the first time I ever did stand-up comedy, I think might've been because of you.
Oh, wow.
Cause I, here's what I remember. So the first time I ever did stand-up comedy was February 29th. It was leap day or leap year, whatever you call it, 2004. Right.
Oh, and wow. I think it's the easy way to remember it.
Yeah. And I had been thinking about doing stand-up for a long time, but I was just too scared to do it. So instead of doing stand-up, I was reading books about how to do stand-up, and I was, you know, reading interviews with stand-up comedians, and you can only do so much of that before you have to just get up on stage and just do it. And I think I remember my friend Dan Klein, who you remember from BU, I think he maybe spoke to you and you told him that you were going to do this open mic night at Dick Doherty's that they were doing every Sunday. And Dan said something like, he's like, I think I might do it too. Do you want to just do it? And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And I was absolutely terrified. But I think it is I think you were technically like sort of the, you know, the
right,
like the impetus. The impetus for me doing stand up.
Oh, that's very cool. I didn't know that. I've probably heard that from at least 10 people in my life, that like the reason I started doing stand-up. It's like, I have this weird, like, the story of my life is basically that I've inspired other great people to do great things, but I never did anything major myself. I'm like a Forrest Gump or something. Like, if you went through some of the weird things that I've like had some sort of part in, but didn't really directly do. I remember I started like the stand-up comedy club, which was like a student group for stand-up comedy, and you and Dan, and it was like Steve McConey and I'm gonna forget a million people now, but
Chris Sartinsky, maybe, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That sounds right.
I forgot about that.
We did a bunch of shows at BU, which were like, mm-hmm. it's funny how like spoiled we were without realizing it. Like, I would just like put up flyers or something, and like 200 people would show up for a stand-up show.
Yeah.
And it was all like, you know, like students who like just laughed at everything. And we were just like, it was so easy to produce a show, but you know, I didn't realize that in the real world, it's like a million times more difficult.
I know. Yeah. I felt the same way. And I think they opened BU Central during our time in college, which essentially could function as like a small stand-up club, which was also like a nice little venue.
Yeah. And I got to like, cause we had a competition. I don't know if it's my freshman or sophomore year, but there was a stand-up competition, which I fortunately won basically because Mike Kaplan was out of town. It's like Mike Kaplan was already like a graduate student, and he was already a pretty like, you know, solid stand-up comic.
Yeah.
But he was out of town, I remember. And so they had this competition, which I ended up winning. I wouldn't have won if he was there, I don't think. But, and then I got to open for Dane Cook.
Dane Cook. Yeah, I remember that.
That was like 6,000 people. Again, I was so spoiled without realizing it. And
yeah, that's right.
And I got to open, they basically just kept having me open for I got to open for Mike Birbiglia and John Mulaney. That was one of the shows.
Oh, just crazy shit.
And then Mike Birbiglia, this is really crazy, but Mike Birbiglia, I ran into him, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years later, like when I was kind of a young stand-up comic in New York, and he completely remembered me. He remembered like everything, like that I opened for him at BU, and I'm thinking, he remembers like a student opener. Like, it's just crazy.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah.
Was that show NBU Central, the Mike Birbiglia?
Yeah, it was.
I think I remember watching that one. That's what made
me, when you said BU Central, I thought of that because I'm thinking like, there were some really big names that did this little, I mean, it was like maybe like 200, you know, 150, 200 students that were doing, like people that now I feel like would be much bigger than, I just think stand-up in general has become more popular since then. And
yeah,
like some of these people that did like these little shows would never do like a little show. I mean, there'd be too many people would want to see them for them to do a little show. Maybe,
you know? Right. I remember, I think our sketch group opened for Eugene Merman one time. I remember that. I remember the John Mulaney show. Yeah, I definitely remember. I remember Dane Cook coming to BU, I think, at two different times in the same year. And one was, when you opened for him. I remember that. That must have been so cool.
That was, yeah, it was amazing. And the coolest thing about it is I remember the feeling of like just getting, because there was like a long line to get in. And I remember just being able to like walk past it and just be like, I'm on the show. You know, like it was such an amazing feeling for like a 19-year-old just to be like, just walk past like blocks of people and be like, I'm on
the show. Oh God, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I remember, this is just going to be entertaining for no one else but you and I, but trips down memory lane.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I remember that you did this crazy thing that was like a competition where it was like a rap battle or something.
Oh, yeah.
You won it. You were like, and your whole shtick was that like you were, instead of bragging about how cool you were basically like a nerd or something like that, right?
Yes, I remember I was bragging. BU had a freestyle rap competition, and I was the only person there who did not take it seriously. Everyone else was really thought they were like Eminem from 8 Mile or something, whereas I was rapping about how, you know, recycling is good and pornography is bad. And I think the audience just enjoyed that. And then I won a really crappy TV and two tickets to a BU women's basketball game, I think.
That was the prize?
I think that was the prize. Yeah, it was.
I couldn't give those away, a women's basketball
game. Yeah. I think they gave, I won, I guess, a flat panel TV, which I don't even know what that is, but it was a flat, not a flat screen TV, a flat panel TV.
Right. Was it like cool at the time, or was it always a shitty TV?
It was an objectively shitty TV. It was clearly a TV that someone had gifted BU, that BU was like, we need to gift this to someone else now. Re-gift it.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Yes, that was very fun. In hindsight, the way you approached that was like, oh, of course this guy's going to be like a writer for a late night, you know, show.
Yeah, I mean, I just couldn't believe that there were actually students that were really taking it seriously. I'm thinking like, you know, we go to Boston University here. We're not real rappers.
But don't you feel like there was like kind of a weird, like BU kind of had a weird student body because for the most part, it was kind of like liberal, like nerdy, you know, a lot of gay kids, a lot of just like progressive nerdy kids. But then there was like also like the kind of like, I'm from Boston and I'm like tough guy type kids that were like there because they had a hockey team or something, like, you know?
I very much remember that. Yeah. There was a big sense of sort of like masculinity in Boston that the variety of which kind of frightened me as, you know, like at a young age, I don't know. It was just that like worrisome masculine energy that I've always been intimidated by.
Yeah. So then what did you do? Like, what'd you do before Fallon? I guess, like, what was your career that, you know, what was your career post-college?
Yeah. Well, so I moved from, you know, I graduated Boston University and then I was deciding between either Chicago or New York. I wanted to pursue comedy. I had no plan, but, some of my friends from, Slow Kids, you know, the sketch group, were moving to New York and we decided to start a sketch comedy group together called Pangea 3000. So that was the really kind of the only comedy thing I had going when I first moved to New York. It's, you know, as you know, it's just very hard to kind of like, you know, get your feet off the ground and get started and everything. So I worked in a bookstore for a couple years, and then I worked as a caterer, and I worked as a nude model, like a figure model for art classes.
No way.
That's yeah. And I was also a Little League umpire for the Prospect Park Baseball Association.
Wow.
So I was doing all those jobs, none of which really involved comedy. But I also was contributing some stuff to The Onion. One of the guys in my group, I think you probably remember Seth Reese, right? Uh-huh. So Seth is, you know, an extremely hardworking person. And I think within a year of him, of graduating college, he got a job as a writer at The Onion. And it was through him that I began to start contributing headlines. And then it's kind of through that I became friends with this guy, Mike DiCenzo, who I think you also remember.
He was my roommate.
Oh, yeah. Did you guys live in, like, what was it, Shelton or something? Or not Shelton.
Miles Standish.
Miles Standish. That's what
yeah.
That was rumored to be, like, that was supposed to be, like, the best haunted dining hall, right?
Oh, was it? No. It was supposedly haunted. And a weird side note, there was, like, a guy that worked at the front desk or whatever, like, that you signed in, and he looked exactly like Jimmy Fallon, and we'd always make, like,
yes,
Jimmy Fallon jokes to him, and then you end up working for, you know, Jimmy Fallon. But
yes, that's right.
And but that's, yeah, funny. Mike, it's funny because Mike and I were just completely randomly, you know, we didn't know each other. We were, like, put together by BU as right. roommates, and, you know, it's kind of weird because we're both, like, end up going into comedy and all that, but we did do, like, a radio show together. We had some funny moments. We had, it's just a really quick story, but we did this, we couldn't stand, oh, kind of like the annoying jock guys we were just talking about. One of them had a radio yeah. show at BU, and it was just like it was supposed to be like a comedy show, but it wasn't funny at all. It was just horrible. And during our show, we were forced to play ads for his show, and the ad was so annoying and obnoxious that we, like, made a parody version of it where we made fun of him. And then one day we're listening to his show and they're like, oh, we have an ad. We have to play our ad, but we don't, like, where is it? Can anybody find it? And we're like, Mike was listening to the show. So he sent in, I was like, you have to send it. So we sent in via AIM, we sent the parody version. And they played it on air thinking it was going to be their real ad. And it was just, like, ripping on this guy. And we thought we were, like, going to create this, like, feud between us and them and stuff. But then they thought our ad was hilarious.
They were like, they liked yeah. your ad.
They thought it was really funny that we took the time to make fun of them. but, yeah, so – okay, sorry. So back to your story. So you get a job working at The Onion?
No, I was just a contributing writer, which all that meant was that I would send in 15 headlines a week. And if I was lucky, I would get, you know, maybe like one or two or occasionally three or four picked to be considered to be in the paper. And then the following day, you would usually find out whether you got any selected for the paper. I think they would basically, because there were so many contributors and the writers, they would basically have a list of about 500 or 600 headlines, and then of those they would choose like 20 to make the paper or something. So your chances of getting a headline published were very small. So I could not make a living wage as a contributing writer at The Onion.
Right.
And I did okay there. I wasn't bad. I would say I was probably about average in terms of like how well I was doing as a like enough to kind of keep doing it for 5 years, but never enough to really be considered as like a candidate for a writing staff position there. But through that, I got to know Mike DiCenzo, who also happened to live just a couple blocks away. So I would go over to his apartment and we would watch either baseball or the show Studio 60. And
I love that show, by the way.
Yeah, I did too. I did it until a certain point. I remember on like the week 10, it was like the 10th or 9th episode of the show or something. They were like, next week on Studio 60. And then someone goes like, there's a snake loose in the studio. And I'm just like, oh no. Oh no, I have to stop. I have to stop watching this show. They shouldn't be getting to the snake episode until season 11, but it's only 9 episodes in. They're on the snake episode.
I remember that came out at the same time when that 30 Rock
30 came Rock. Out.
And they're both shows about making SNL, more or less. And I remember I started with Studio 60 and I remember being very loyal to it and like not watching 30 Rock because I was like, what is this? Like, I'm a Studio 60 fan. And then I eventually watched 30 Rock and I was like, oh, this is like even better. This is the greatest show.
I was the same way too. My friends and I, we, for some reason, we all kind of like looked down on Studio on 30 Rock. We, you know, we were like, the Aaron Sorkin show is going to be so much better. And I'm like, why did we have, why did we feel that we needed to even choose one over the other? But no, I remember I was very into Studio 60. I was very interested in following the story arc about this, the sketch Crazy Christians. Do you remember Crazy Christians?
The, you did the character that was Christian? What are you talking about?
No, no, no. Crazy Christians was the Studio 60 sketch. It was this like infamous sketch within, you know, the world of Studio 60. That was so controversial that it, you know, drove viewers away because it was just some, you know, attack on Christianity. And they talked about it for many episodes and then finally they showed the sketch and it was like a B minus sketch.
I remember, I mean, I remember the general conflict of like the lead actress who's now in that show Ratchet.
Sarah Paulson.
Yeah. Her being a Christian and being at odds with Matthew Perry. And it was very clearly the relationship between Aaron Sorkinson and that blonde musical woman that's was his girlfriend at the time.
Oh, I don't remember.
She's a very famous like Broadway actress, and she was his girlfriend, and she was very Christian. He's very like atheist. So it was very clearly just their relationship in a TV show.
Well, yeah. So I got to know Mike kind of through that, and he was the first. You know, friend of mine who got any sort of TV writing job. So that was, I was like 24, I think, when he got hired. He was a writer at The Onion, and then he became, I think he was maybe the first writer that they hired at Late Night with Jimmy Fallon when Fallon was going to be taking over for Conan. So that was a very exciting thing. But it didn't really mean anything, you know, for me other than like, oh, cool, I have a friend who's, you know, in the TV world now. But then, yeah, I, you know, he was, Mike was a fan of my sketch comedy group, Pangea 3000. And then I also started another sketch comedy group called Two Fun Men with my friend John Haskell. And Mike was a fan of that too. And so over this time, you know, I was very involved at the UCB Theater. So Pangea would put up sketch shows. I was doing the Two Fun Men show. I would do, you know, like improv shows. I was on like a house, like they, you know, the Herald Night team that they have there. And, you know, I made a web series with Dan Klein. And, so, you know, I was kind of busy doing, you know, comedy stuff. And then I, you know, I was lucky enough to be able to get asked by Mike DeCenza to occasionally appear in bit parts on Fallon. You know, if you're a writer there at the show, you basically are also producing the bits or the sketches that you're doing, which means that if there's any casting involved, you are sort of in charge of casting it. So, you know, a lot of times I would be in one of Mike's pieces that would, you know, where I, if I was lucky, I would get like one line, you know, like, and because the difference in money between one line and zero lines would be the difference in like whether I, like whether I was like paying my rent that month or something.
Yeah.
So it was very exciting for me. And it was just thrilling to go to 30 Rock. I mean, my long time dream was to be a, you know, to be on the show Saturday Night Live. But I always was really a big fan of like Conan growing up and Letterman and, you know, those like late night shows. So that was very exciting. But yeah, so Jimmy came to see the Two Fun Men show at Mike DeCenza's, you know, request. Mike was, you know, kind of recommended him to see the show. Jimmy came to see it. Jimmy liked the show, and then a couple months later they did not hire me, but they hired my friend John, who was in Two Fun Men with me. And I remember that was a very difficult thing to kind of have your best friend get sort of picked over you. You know, I was happy for him, but I also, you know, was worried that I had missed my, you know, opportunity.
Right.
So then I kind of doubled down over the next year and was really focused on trying to do an SNL audition. Because also at this point I had submitted 3 packets to Fallon and not gotten, you know, staffed. So I was kind of assuming that my time there was maybe over. And I was about, I was still doing bit parts on Fallon. I was about ready to kind of give up on it when one day I showed up for, to rehearse a sketch, and Jimmy just kind of surprise hired me on the spot, you know, which was a, like unbelievably exciting and terrifying thing to have happen. But yeah, that was 2012. So that was how
he had planned on doing that, or was it?
Yes, I think I had now at this point submitted my fourth and what I was assuming would be my final packet. I'm like, I can't submit another packet to the show. It's just pathetic at this point.
Even doing one is like difficult. Like it takes a lot of time and effort. Like people who are listening who don't write comedy might not know, like to submit a packet is like a week of work probably or something like that.
Yeah, totally. If you're going to really put effort into it, because I've now been in the position where I have read a lot of packets as a sketch supervising writer at Fallon, and it's very easy to tell which people, you know, kind of put their packet together over the course of a week and which ones do it in a couple hours on, you know, a Tuesday or whatever. Right. But yeah, I did work hard on mine, and you know, I think just the fact that Jimmy was familiar with me and, you know, we had talked a little bit and he liked my Two Fun Men show, I think that stuff helped too. Mm-hmm. So I really honestly attribute a lot of my being a writer there to just the luck and timing of knowing Mike DiCenzo. I'd like to be able to say that it was just skill or merit or something like that, but it was not that. It was there was some of that involved, but there was also the fact that I was friends with a guy who was the most successful writer at Fallon and was therefore very trusted by Jimmy. Jimmy did I think it was his idea earlier that day to kind of surprise, they knew that they wanted to hire me at that point, and he was like, they knew that I was coming in to do a sketch that day, so Jimmy was like, oh yeah, I'll like surprise hire him on the floor, and it was a really nice thing.
So how did he do it? Like, what did he say?
So I remember this. I have a video of it somewhere on like a hard drive, but he set me up for like my one line in the sketch. He would just be like in the sketch, he'd be like, how you doing, buddy? Because I would play a fake page a lot of the time. And if he would say, how are you doing? That would basically just give me free license to say whatever I wanted. He wouldn't even ask me what I was going to say. My goal would be to try to just make Jimmy laugh. Uh-huh. So I think I said something like, I'm pretty good. I got lunch with my uncle 3 months ago, so I'm doing well. And then he goes, oh, Arthur, by the way, I read your packet. And I go, what? And he goes, I read your packet. It was great. And I go, oh, thank you. And I didn't know what he was getting at. And then he goes, yeah, do you want to work here? And and this is like on the studio floor in front of the Roots, in front of the crew. And I was, you know, I just said, yes. And, you know, then I think I said, do I still have to do this shit? and then a funny thing happened, which was that sketch was very bad. And it ended up getting cut on the, it got cut that day, which is actually great for me because I just got to, you know, go home and, you know, call my parents and, you know, call people and stuff. It was a really exciting day for me.
Oh, very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I do want to be clear that a lot of my getting there at the show truly had to do with luck and timing. I think a lot of times people like to think that their, you know, quote unquote success is just based on merit or whatever, but I could probably go back further and even, you know, for instance, even at Boston University, you know, I happened to get lucky enough to be, you know, I was in a sketch comedy group with a bunch of other people who also loved doing comedy. And, you know, I think other college groups, I think people like doing comedy and everything, but this was a bunch of people who happened to take it really seriously. And I think that was luck, you know, like I worked with, very funny people.
I think, you know, luck is an element of it. And especially like in the direction your career goes. But I mean, what I'm hearing is a lot of you putting yourself in position to get lucky, right? I mean, if like your career is like a mosaic of all these little things and you don't know what little thing you're going to do is going to lead to that big thing. But, you know, you first of all, you got into the sketch group, which was difficult. Like a lot of people were auditioning for it and at BU, I mean, and then you're doing these like UCB things and like, I think that people who are trying to get into comedy and they don't know how, it's like, you got to just start doing stuff, right? Like, and you're doing stuff, you'll network and meet other people, and everything will end up, you know, kind of, you know, catapulting you to where you should end up in life. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're, and you know, an amount of persistence is important too, right? Because it's like you submitted four times.
Yeah.
And I definitely, I know, like, just speaking from my own account, like a lot of times I've like put a lot of work into a packet and then I submit it and I don't get it. And I'm like, well, fuck that. Yeah, I don't, totally. It's like hearing your story, I'm like, I guess I should have submitted like three more times. Cause for all I know, they're like, wow, we really like, love this packet, but like, let's see what else he's got. You know what I mean?
But, well, I think also part of the reason I submitted that many times is because I didn't really have any other sort of plan. I was always just kind of like, well, this is sort of, I know someone who works at Fallon. So, you know, I think I kind of inadvertently put all of my eggs in that basket and didn't really have to. It did, yeah. I mean, another way that it was, I think, an overlap of sort of luck and skill aspect was that, you know, Jimmy was the host of the show. And I do not think I would be particularly great at writing for a show like Colbert, you know, or like John Oliver. I think I would not be good at that. Right. That feels like going back to grad school or something like that to write one of those pieces. Whereas Jimmy was someone who I always felt a certain kinship with when I used to watch him on SNL. You know, I liked him. You know, I thought I didn't always like him, but for the most part, I really did, and I could really sense his passion for not just sketch comedy, but for Saturday Night Live. And you could just see it come through. And I was obsessed with Saturday Night Live as a kid. Like, I memorized the dates of all the episodes of the show. And like, it was truly an obsession. And I think Jimmy's comedic sensibility and mine, I think there's a lot of overlap, especially in the area of kind of silliness, musicality, stupidity, and kind of simplicity, you know. It's, you know, Jimmy was never like the Tonight Show or Late Night with Jimmy Fallon was never very, you know, super politically oriented. And that was a plus for me because I was not either, you know.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it's definitely easiest to write for someone that has a similar kind of point of view, similar voice. I know that I've tried to like write before for like packets for like people where I'm like, it's like, I can get in the mindset of someone else, but yeah, it definitely, it's going to come easier if it's just someone that, you know, you already kind of share some sort of sensibility with.
Yeah. That is kind of what you're trying to do though. I mean, you basically are in a way trying to kind of get into their head sort of, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of writing for that show would almost be like, well, what will Jimmy want to do? And I kind of think that makes sense. I mean, it's, you know, you're basically, you know, whoever the person is who's hosting the show. And I mean, I think this goes for any comedy. Like when you're a stand-up comedian, the thing that will work best is the thing that you do best, you know, the thing that you, or whatever those things are, you know, like it needs to be you channeling your purest self. And that will also be what works best. So it's this weird game of like trying to kind of get in someone else's head. Yeah. Which almost sounds perverted when I put it that way.
I wrote for Rob Dyrdek for a few years, Ridiculousness. And he and I could not have different, like more different points of view. It's like it was so, because like the joke that would always win would be, it was that we were showing clips, right? It's Ridiculousness, like, and the joke that would always end up winning in the room, we had a really talented writer's room, but the joke that always win from Rob's perspective was like, saying what the character in the clip was thinking. And it was always like, whoa, I'm about to fall, man. You know, like, and like, meanwhile, I did not like get that at first. And I kept trying to write like heady jokes that were like, I just remember this one time, the joke I came up with, it was like a horse that was acting like super crazy. And I was like, oh, when he dies, they'll turn him into crazy glue or something like that. And they just looked at me like, what? Like, what are you talking about? And I just remember being like, you know, because horses become glue and you'd be crazy glue. It was like the look on everyone's face, like, that's not what this show is, you know?
Oh, God. But, it's so funny to me. There are fewer things that are funnier to me than when an attempt at comedy just is not doesn't land. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But okay, so what would, like, in general, what would be your advice to someone who's trying to get, like, a job working at a late night show or something like that?
Yeah, I think you kind of have to sort of make yourself, I really hate the language that I'm about to use, but I think you kind of have to make yourself relevant in some way. And I think that could be in just like any way. I think that there are a million ways to do that. I think part of the cool thing about late night comedy and the way that they hire their writers is that there actually are a lot of different avenues into it. Like, there would be writers at Fallon who got hired basically on the strength of their Twitter account. I know that there was a writer at Seth Meyers who I think I'm getting this right. This guy Brian Donaldson, who was, I think, working, I want to say, as like an IT guy in Peoria, Illinois, or something like that. He was like 40 years old, and he had a Twitter account that happened to be followed by the head writer of their show. And when they were staffing, I think they asked him for, you know, if he wanted to submit a packet, and he's now been a writer there for almost 7 years, you know.
Wow, that's a crazy story.
Yeah, whereas for me, I took more of the route of getting involved in the live, you know, comedy theater UCB scene, where I was doing sketch and improv. And then, yeah, I think just, you know, like putting stuff online, or like, you know, if you have like an Instagram presence, I think that, you know, like basically any way that you could just kind of stand out and get yourself noticed. I will say that a lot of times the packets were important, but at least in my time as a sketch supervising writer at Fallon, I found that it was a little bit hard to kind of distinguish personalities of people just based on their packet, unless they really did something they sort of stand out. I'm not even saying that they necessarily need to do anything crazy, but it's just, whenever we would get a packet, I would always look that person up online and try to see kind of like, what is their actual sense of humor, like what is their own sensibility? Because I think when you're trying to staff a late night writing show, I think you're basically thinking about it in the sense of like almost how a sports team would be put together. Mm-hmm. You know, you have like, I don't know, 15 people or something, and you know, you wouldn't have a basketball team of entirely centers, you know, or entirely point guards. You want to kind of mix it up, and you want to have, like, if it's football, you know, you have your special teams guy, you have your quarter, you know, like you have all these different positions, and you kind of want to try to fill all of those holes at a late night show.
Specifically, what would you, you know, moving the analogy specifically to comedy writers, like what would be the different types of comedy writers then?
I think at a place like Fallon, there would be monologue joke writers who are just really good at writing just your standard like one-liner, setup, punchline kind of joke. There would be people who are really good at musical stuff, and you could submit musical things in your packet. People who just had really good sketch ideas. You know, there were people who would have kind of good writerly sketch ideas, which is to say an idea with like a real sort of concept and premise behind it. Whereas then there were some people who were really good at just something that was very simple that didn't necessarily have much of a premise to it, but was just kind of fun and funny to watch. I'm not quite sure how to describe that, but we had different people. Like we had one writer at our show who I feel like found his niche with sort of like found comedy type stuff. Like there were a couple segments on the show called Do Not Play and Do Not Read, where Jimmy would sort of look through like, you know, actual books and actual records and just play them on the show, or take a look at the cover of the book on the show and stuff. And that writer, you know, was very good at like finding that kind of stuff and finding stuff that really kind of tickled Jimmy's, you know, funny bone or whatever. So yeah, I think that, you know, I think writing for a late night show is largely about just finding, like, what is your overlap with the show? What is the middle part of that Venn diagram that works for both you and that works for the show? Because you don't want to just only be writing stuff that only works for the show, because then it's not going to have any hint of your own comedic personality in it. Right. But at the same time, you're not going to only want to write stuff that's only for you, because then it just won't get on the show. So the goal is basically to try, because you're writing for a host, you have to really keep them in mind, but you also really want to inject your own, you know, sensibility into it. Otherwise, why did you become a comedian? So you want to try to get that middle part of that Venn diagram, you know? Right. Yeah. So we would have like bits for the show that I think sometimes would get on the show and would, you know, you weren't necessarily like super proud of it, but it would sort of get the job done and make, you know, get the audience to laugh and everything. But then you would sometimes have bits on the show that you were genuinely really passionate about and loved. And sometimes those felt a little bit harder to get on the show, but when you did get those on the show, it was just thrilling, because it was like, oh wow, I can't believe this idea that feels so personal to me got on the show. And those were always my favorite ones to get on.
So did you get to interact with SNL at all, working in the same building?
Yeah, well, I got to interact. I mean, I was friends with a lot of the people who worked there. I got, over my years at Fallon, I got to work with a lot of the cast members and writers, actually, who really influenced me. And I ended up auditioning for SNL in 2018, and I did not get the job. But yeah, I had a lot of...
As a writer or performer?
As a performer. Yeah.
You actually have some great, I was just watching your Fallon reel today, and you do some really good impressions. I didn't realize.
Oh, thank you.
Seth Rogen and Shaq.
Yeah.
Like, these are good. Like, I never knew you as like, you know, an impressions guy. But.
Yeah. I don't think I actually have a ton of them, but I think I was able to do about the amount that I'm capable of doing in my SNL audition. But over, you know, over time, you know, I was at Fallon for like 7 years. And if you're there at a show like that for that long, you will eventually end up using anything that's in your comedy toolbox at all, you know? So, I mean, I remember my friend David and I used to do Shaq impressions when we were in high school. We would just do impressions of him rapping, or what we imagined his rap to sound like, because we never actually listened to his rap, but we always were just like, what is it? Is it just like, shoot the ball, dribble the ball, slam dunk the ball, out of bounds the ball, inbounds the ball, pass the ball, 360 degrees of a dunk. And then there was some story about Shaq like coming out with a podcast, and so that it seemed like a natural thing to try to just, oh yeah, I'll try to do my Shaq impression on the show. Voice only, I should stress, not a visual
impression. You never did blackface, because I want to cancel you on this podcast.
So Shaq came on the show one time, and he
was in your reel. He said he was gonna beat you up.
He goes, yo, I'm gonna kick your ass. He liked the podcast, and he featured it on his own. I mean, he liked our Shaq podcast thing that we did, and then he featured it on his own podcast. But when he came on the show to talk about it, immediately after his interview, he walks back into the hall, and I was just kind of waiting there, hoping to just actually meet him. And his head is almost touching the ceiling, and he just goes, Where's the guy that has my voice? And I go, oh, that's me. And he goes, let's hear the voice. And I go, hey, what's going on? It's me, Shaq. And he goes, yeah, that's me.
That's funny.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, it was like one of the most exciting things to be able to work with, you know, like SNL cast members on the show.
Yeah.
You know, and writers like Robert Smigel or Dana Carvey, Will Ferrell, right. Like just people who I definitely idolized as a kid.
Yeah, me too. I think you and I are probably in a similar boat, where I feel like that like mid-90s cast is like what formed my sense of what comedy is like.
Yes. You know, did you watch the show pretty regularly?
Oh yeah. It's like obsessed with it. Yeah. Yeah. Like that specific cast of like, it was like David Spade and Chris Farley and Mike Myers and Adam Sandler. And like, I don't know. I love that cast, you know, I just like,
yeah,
I'm sure a lot of the sketches didn't work, but in my mind, like everything just was always hilarious.
That's kind of how I remember it too. I that's how I think of that era. And that was always the era that I pointed to as like my favorite cast. Cause there were just so many, I mean, yeah, you know, like just, yeah, Tim Meadows and Chris Rock and Mike Myers, Rob Schneider, I thought was really funny on the show. Like, I thought they had like 10 or 12 like amazing cast members.
Yeah. So what was like a typical day like at Fallon? Like, you know, like you come in, like, I don't know, just like walk me through a day, I guess.
Yeah, well, usually in the morning, we would focus on pitching mono bits for the show. So monologue bits that would break up kind of the one-liners that Jimmy would do. So this would basically be anything involving graphics or anything, any sort of like live bit, where it's maybe like an interaction between Jimmy and a writer, or Jimmy and someone from the Roots or something. We would usually, every writer was supposed to pitch, the number always varied over time. I think there was a time when we were pitching like 3 per day, which is a lot. And yeah, so if you got a mono bit, you would pitch that in the morning, and you know, you would get a list of like news premises or news stories that were all kind of written as premises. So you would kind of try to pitch on whatever was going on in the news. And if your idea got picked, you would spend your morning kind of preparing that bit for the 12:30 creative meeting, which is when Jimmy would kind of read through all the potential mono bits. He would read through sketches that were going to be on the show that day, or he would read through ideas that we were pitching for guests in the future. So, you know, you would either be kind of preparing your mono bit to be seen by Jimmy, which means kind of putting your, you know, script in front of him, or getting together any like graphic elements that you need, like music or graphics. And if you had a sketch that was going to be on the show that day or that week, you would, you know, be getting your script ready for that, or talking to various production elements of the show. You know, maybe you're talking to the wardrobe people or the props people, or talking to, you know, someone from the Roots about a musical, you know, need that you'll have. So the morning is kind of spent getting things ready for Jimmy to see. Then Jimmy has that meeting at you know, at 12:30, and he kind of goes through everything and just says, you know, yes or no to it. And then in the afternoon, if you have something on the show that day, you kind of show up to rehearsal, and you know, you're there for the blocking rehearsal, and you're there for when Jimmy comes down to rehearse it. And you're basically just making sure that everything looks good, and that, you know, there's no loose ends or anything like that. If you don't have anything on the show that day, you're usually then writing, working on other assignments for the show. So like there's a segment, thank you notes on the show, you know, maybe you're spending, you know, a couple hours submitting thank you notes or writing thank you notes. Maybe there's a guest coming on in a couple weeks and you're trying to think of some pitches. There kind of isn't really an exact, you know, plan necessarily. Like there's plenty of time for writers to just kind of like, you know, fuck around, which I think is good and should be essential at any comedy job. So you could do that too. But you know, you'll also have to make sure that you meet the deadlines and submit, you know, assignments and stuff like that. So it's kind of just, yeah, it was sort of a nonstop job. You know, the show would tape at 5 every day, and then it would be over by 6:15, 6:30. But then the writers would usually stay at the show until, I don't know, I stayed fairly late. When I was a writer, I would stay until maybe 8 or 8:30. And then when I was a sketch supervising writer, I was often there until 9 or maybe 10 at night.
And then I would go home. What are you doing at that point?
At that point, you're doing kind of the same things. You're just, you know, you're writing a sketch, or you're producing your, you know, sketch, or you're thinking of something for a pitch. Maybe there's going to be a pitch meeting coming up with Jimmy. Jimmy would have pitch meetings with the writers every once in a while. So there's just kind of like constant meetings and like deadlines and assignments.
So it'd be pretty hard to, like, for instance, do stand up at the same time, like go out to do a show after you've just spent all day at a job and like work till 9 or something.
Yeah. I tried it for a little bit of a little bit of time. I mean, I had a UCB show, a solo show that I did sometime in my first year as a writer at Fallon. But I think part of the reason I was able to do that was because I wasn't getting a ton of stuff on the show in my first year. So I would actually sort of have more time to go and do my show. But I was always kind of blown away by a few writers who would still be able to regularly go out and do stand-up gigs. I never knew how they were able to do that and the job too. It seemed really difficult.
Yeah. It's hard. It's hard when you're doing one, like a creative thing all day long to then be like,
yeah,
well, I'm going to go, oh, by the way, a highly paid creative thing, and then go, I'm going to go out to a club and do this non-paid creative thing. It's like, at that point, you're just tired, right? You just like want to go home and watch Studio 60, but.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, at that point, yeah, you want to go home and watch the show that is not a comedy show, usually. Yeah. You would rather watch Studio 60 like, than 30 Rock.
A murder documentary or something. I find that I weirdly, like, I used to watch so much comedy, and like lately, I don't know if, I just feel like most comedy kind of sucks at this point, but
yeah,
I watch so much more just like, yeah, like true crime and just things that have nothing to do with comedy. It's funny.
I'm the same way. And just music also is something that I've gotten like very into over the last decade or so. Just like things that aren't comedy related seem to be the things that I enjoy watching the most. Right.
Yeah. So do you think that it's possible that you maybe would just do stand up every 4 years on leap year? Cause I think that'd be kind of cute.
I actually really like that idea.
An anniversary show every 4 years.
Yeah. This would have been my fifth leap year of doing it this year. Actually, I think I almost did it on leap year. I don't think I did it on leap year this year, but yeah, that's so funny.
What do you wish you had known, like, before you, I don't know, before, like, let's say you were graduating from college and you wanted to get into comedy, or at that point in your life, what do you wish you'd known then that you know now?
That there's not really, I think what I wish I had known then was that it's okay to have fear and anxiety, and that those are actually oftentimes integral parts of being a comedian. I think I maybe spent a lot of energy in college and even in my professional career trying to kind of fight against the fear and the anxiety that I had, trying to kind of keep it at bay, or at least present myself to people in a way where they couldn't tell that I was anxious. And it wasn't until sometime when I was at Fallon, I remember talking to Dana Carvey, who I was assigned to produce a piece that he was doing on the show. And I talked to him backstage and we got into a discussion about nervousness. And he told me that when he was on Saturday Night Live in his very first episode, so this is 1986, they did the very first church lady sketch. And in the dress rehearsal of the show, it was the last sketch of the night, but it killed. So they moved it up to being the first sketch after the monologue for the live show. And Dana Carvey had not done sketch comedy before, which is astounding to me because he was like 30. I think he was 32 when he got cast on SNL, and he just seems like someone who has sketch comedy like in their blood. But he had only done stand up to that point. Wow. So he said that he was crying in his dressing room before the show, you know, because he was just terrified. And he said that in the first season or two of his time on SNL, if you watch him in any sketches, you could see his hands. His palms and stuff, they're sweaty. And I told him, I was like, that's so crazy, because I have kind of I've always had sort of a little nervous tremor. My hand kind of shakes when I perform. Not always, but just if I'm nervous, it will shake. And he said, yeah, don't worry about that. Like, allow it to shake if that's what's happening. Just, you know, the audience doesn't mind seeing nervousness as long as they also see that you're invested in the bit that you're doing. So that really helped, was to not necessarily try to fight the nervousness or the anxiety, but to almost sort of embrace it and maybe even let the energy of that kind of motivate your performance, or, you know, motivate something. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you have had, you know, anxiety as a comedian over the years. I mean, to me, it feels like it's just a built-in part of so many of like comedians in general, that you're basically basing your sort of value on audible approval of an audience. Like, how could you not have that insecurity, you know?
Well, with stand up, I used to be so nervous when I first started. I mean, I started when I was really young. I started when I was only 16. And
oh, wow.
I pretty quickly had success. Like, as a teenager, I like booked in Ohio some like headlining gigs and stuff, and like like went from being like, oh, I've got like 5 minutes of material, to like, oh, you've got to go entertain an Elks club for like 45 minutes type thing, you know? So that those like really made me nervous, because I'm like, I mean, frankly, half my jokes were like, they're like from the perspective of like a 16-year-old, right? So it's like, it's like, hey, like, teachers suck, and they, how about Tamagotchis? Huh? You know? But like, and then there's like these old like hillbillies that I'm supposed to entertain. I remember, and I just remember just being so nervous all the time. Like, there was one show I keep thinking of too specifically, where I just bombed so hard. And I think it kind of takes bombing a few times, where you're like, yeah, where you go, okay, well, that was the worst thing that could happen. And it wasn't the, like, it sucked.
It wasn't that bad.
Yeah, yeah, it sucked. But at the end of the day, like, do I really care what a bunch of like, you know, hillbillies think about me? Like, I kind of don't. So it's like, it got to a point though, eventually, where like, I'm actually, it's odd how not nervous I am. Like, I'm like more comfortable on stage than I am in real life. Like, to a fault. Like, sometimes I'll like scratch my butt or like do something really weird on stage where it's like I forget almost that there's like people looking at me. But it's funny, you don't strike me as someone who gets, I'm kind of surprised that you have these hand tremors and stuff, because I'm like, I'm watching your reel and there's a lot of courage it takes to like, I mean, you're like almost nude in like a dozen sketches at least, or you're like down to like a Borat outfit and running around or something. So that takes a lot of courage. I think a lot of guys wouldn't be willing to, especially you know, if they don't have a six pack, let's say, like, you know, show off their body and run around.
Well, you know what's funny for me is that for doing, and I've been actually literally full frontal naked on a couple of TV shows on Shrill and High Maintenance. Like, I've looked like, and there's something about being naked that makes me less nervous. And I think it's because I don't have to really necessarily do a ton of the comedy. It'll just be my body that's kind of taking over for the time being. That sounds sort of weird to say, but it's like, well, there's just this beautiful,
like, you already know they're laughing at you, so it's like,
yes, exactly, and it kind of takes a little bit of the pressure off, and yeah
it's funny.
You also, like, you also can't get more, you can't get more naked than naked, so like in a weird way being naked is almost like you're just facing your, you know, fear just laid out bare in front of you. And it's, yeah, like you said, with bombing, it's really not that, I mean, it feels really bad in the moment, but then you remember, like, nobody died, you know, I'm not a doctor, this isn't actually like a very important job, you know. Like,
so I gotta tell you a story that relates to this. So when I was doing comedy in Boston, there was this guy named Andy O'Fish, who,
I remember Andy.
Okay, you do. So he ran the Naked Comedy Show. You remember?
Yes.
That? Yeah.
Yep.
So I did it in Boston when I was in college. I asked him if I could do it, and he was like, yeah, like, of course. And I was kind of surprised, right? Because it was always kind of hard to get on shows, you know? And then,
yeah.
And he was just like, so, like, of course you can do it. And I would realize years later, because I produced a naked show, that, like, it's really hard to get people to do it. So it's like, of course, when someone asks, you're like, yeah, of course you can.
Oh, that's funny.
Because, you know, there's this huge barrier that is like, most people don't want to be naked, basically. So anyways, I asked if I could do it. I did it. I had a great time. And then I moved to New York, and I was like, I mean, that show would always just sell out so easily. And it was really hard to produce shows. So I was like, well, what if I just produced a naked show? So I asked Andy if he wanted to be involved. And he and I produced a naked comedy show in New York at the Pit, the People's Improv Theater.
Right.
And we'd have, I mean, it was really hard to ask, especially like girls. Like, I mean, that's kind of weird, right? To like be like, hey, female comic, like, do you want to do a naked comedy show? Like, so I pretty much didn't really ask. I didn't ask girls. I would, like, if they came to me, I would book them, of course. But then Andy did a lot of the booking too. But I like, we had Eric Andre a lot, because he was great. So I ended up, you know, doing the show every month, and it'd always be sold out. It was always great. It was a great source of stage time. But I do think that was a big part of me no longer being nervous about comedy. Cause it's like, if you can go up there and literally be naked It's like, how much worse can it get, right? Like,
yeah, totally. That was a big thing for me when I was a new figure model, like a new model for art classes. It's like, people would often ask, well, would you get nervous for that? And it's like, yeah, you get a little nervous, but then, yeah, once you're naked, you can't get more naked than naked. You know, that's it. I even seem to remember Andy maybe talking about the reason that he got into it had something to do with like therapy or something, that like he was talking with his therapist and they encouraged him to try doing it. Yeah.
I met him at the studio, comedy studio, and he would always do these jokes about having a little dick. Mm-hmm. And frankly, when he was clothed, the jokes were okay, but they, you know, they weren't landing super hard or anything. So then I go do the naked show the first time, and you actually see, like, I mean, he has like a micro penis. Like,
I remember that was a real thing. Yeah.
And so when he's doing these jokes about his little dick, it's hilarious. It's hilarious. Yeah. seeing him do the joke. It's like, and he would kill. He would absolutely kill as a nude comedian. And I ended up writing a lot of jokes that were like dick based. Like, I would come out and I'd have a little little thing next to my dick, and it would say like applaud meter, like as if like my dick would go up if
the, oh right.
And then like if a joke didn't land, I would like tap on the tip of my dick and be like, is this thing on? But
was most of your material that you did about being naked? I mean, that like, no. when you perform naked, I mean.
No. Eric Andre was like that. He would go up and just riff about being naked, and he would kill.
Yeah.
I, for the most part, I don't know if this was the right strategy or not, but I always approach stand-up comedy as like, how do I put this? It was never like about that show. It was always like, I'm building an act. And like the show I'm doing right now is like just practice towards like this act that I'm building, you know, like, so. And I wanted all my material to always be evergreen and to be, you know what I mean? Like, I was always trying to like build material that I could use in the future. So I very rarely would, I'd always start off my set with something germane, relevant to that day, that night, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. I think like as a stand-up comic, you have to like acknowledge like, hey, you know, like if you're doing a naked show, especially, it's like, hey, we're at a naked show. Here are jokes about... So I'd spend like the first minute doing that, but then it was always like, now it's all just jokes I'd do at any club.
Yeah, I remember as an audience member too, it was always really, because I watched a few of those shows. I think I even saw you guys at the Pit one time, which I had forgotten about until you mentioned that you did the show at the Pit, but I do think I remember being there for one of them.
You could have done it. I wish you had done it now.
I remember I tried to do it in Boston, but I think there was a rare night where they actually had like too many comedians or something. So I couldn't do it, but I do remember watching the shows. It was really interesting how after a while you would not necessarily forget that the person was naked, but you would sort of stop focusing on it.
And as the performer too, the first time I ever did it, that show in Boston, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be terrifying. Like, I'm just going to be thinking about how I'm naked the whole time. It wasn't like that at all. Like, after the first 10 seconds, all I was ever thinking about is like, what's my next joke? What's my next joke? You know, like, I totally forgot almost that I was naked. It was like, so I don't know. It was a weird, it made me much more comfortable with nudity too in general. Like, I was like, oh, okay. It became like less taboo to me, I guess, or something.
Yeah.
And even just being backstage all the time with all the other naked people. And there's a lot of like cute naked female comics that would be do the show, and they'd just be like backstage naked, and it almost makes it like, I don't know, it's hard to explain. It's like you spend so much of your life like trying to picture what a girl looks like naked that when they're actually naked, it's like less sexy. It's like just kind of like, oh, okay, like, you know, it's like but
wait, that's so funny that people at the show backstage were naked.
Yeah.
Like, I guess that makes sense, but for some reason in my mind, I just assumed that, oh, you know, you get naked like right before you go out or something.
I'll tell you a crazy story that I might cut from the podcast, but so I had a sketch group. It was me and Barry Rothbart. Do you know Barry Rothbart?
Yeah, and was it also Mark Norman?
No, not Mark Norman. There's
for some reason, maybe I'm confusing him with Barry Rothbart. Who was the third guy?
Well, the third guy, for the most part, was Mike Ennis. And then a couple of times it was like Nick Turner. I know we had Brooks Whelan one time who ended up being on SNL.
Okay. But, I definitely saw you guys perform once or twice at the Pit, I think.
Yeah. So we did a show. We had our own show at the Pit, but then we also would do the Naked show sometimes. Mainly because, you know, I was one of the producers, so I was like, okay, like, let's go do a sketch. And we'd always just have like one of the people be naked basically in the sketch. And we tried to write like naked specific sketches. So we wrote this sketch where I don't even remember the premise. The sketch was basically that a guy was like auditioning for like a romance novel, or he was reading a romance novel, whatever it was. There's a guy on stage who's kind of homophobic, and then like a naked man comes out with an erection and is trying to like converse with him, or like doing something with him, and he's like really uncomfortable that there's a naked guy at his audition with him or something. So in the script, like, I was the naked guy, right? So I was supposed to be completely erect. which I didn't realize when writing it is like borderline impossible to do, like to literally come out onto a comedy show erect. It's like impossible. you're way too nervous. So instead I came out on my cue just kind of like stretching my penis up. And there's someone who's reading over the PA system, and he's like, his throbbing hard penis, like everything's about how incredibly I don't know.
Oh my god, that is so funny. That is hilarious.
Yeah, so on that note, so what did you do after Fallon? You said you were working on a project recently.
I mean, I've really honestly been, I was sort of writing a couple of pilot scripts, and I'm sort of now in a place where I'm considering possibly leaving the comedy world. I'm not sure if I'm going to or not, but I don't know. It feels like there's a lot of things in flux right now, and that, you know, I don't know. I started doing some volunteer jobs recently, helping distribute food and water, and supplies to homeless people in Lower Manhattan. And doing something like that feels at least like you can get kind of an immediate sort of, that there's something tangible that you could sort of do. Whereas I've found that with the world of comedy and entertainment in general, there's just so much built-in uncertainty that you just don't know whether something will happen or not. And that's just part of it, you know? And I just feel very lucky that I got to, you know, work at Fallon for as long as I did. So I don't know, I might just be kind of taking like a little break right now or something. But I don't know, did you leave comedy for a little bit or for?
I did, yeah. I've had a weird last few years where I pretty much stepped away from it completely at one point. I was married at the time, and I was pretty, my then wife was not really that into my comedy career, let's say. So she was, and she was always kind of the mindset of like, oh, you're very smart and you're very capable. Like, you could do more with your life than, you know, trying to fucking still go do $50 stand-up gigs and stuff, you know? So So I went to school to get an MBA. First of all, I had to like study to get in and everything. And I got into USC and I did 1 year of, it's a 2-year program, and I did 1 year of it. And then I did an internship for like a restaurant corporation. And I was just immediately like, oh, this is not me. Like, this sucks. I hate this. And I was like, I was more interested in, like, I'd sit in meetings and they'd talk about like their the creative team, like what they came up with for like the Twitter and stuff. And I'd think that sucks. Like, I'm like, I could do better than that, you know? And I'm thinking like, I'm like, this just isn't like, I'm on the wrong side of this right now. Like, I kind of didn't know what I was going to do next, but I quit the MBA program and, thought, okay, I'm gonna, like, I started doing stand up again. Mm-hmm. And, was kind of like, I'm not sure. I still, at this point, I'm kind of, my thing right now is, well, part of why I went to MBA school in the first place is I've just become really interested in business and the stock market especially. And so I had a condo in LA and then I sold it and I put all that money into the stock market basically. Mm-hmm. And like, I gotta tell you, with the pandemic, like short selling on the way down and then buying on the way up, I've just made like crazy money from the pandemic. Mm-hmm. and like to a point where I'm like, I kind of don't need to work anymore, which is nice. I have this kind of like mindset of like, well, now I don't have to do something for money. Like I can just do whatever I want to do. Right. So it's like, question is like, well, what do I want to do? You know? And yeah. I think for me, what I want to do is like either make a TV show or make a movie. So I wrote and produced a pilot script recently, which was a parody of the show 90 Day Fiance. It's a reality show that.
I know about that show. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it turned out really well and the experience was really fun. So, and then there were these two actors from that were really fun. It was just mm-hmm. really funny. They played conjoined twins. Well, they're brothers that identify as conjoined twins. So they're not actually conjoined, but they like pretend to be attached to each other. And they're it was just really, really funny. So right now I'm writing a movie where it's basically the same two characters go to a haunted house. Like it's called The Conjuring. So it's like, it's like The Conjuring. but with conjoined twins. So that's really fun. So I don't know. Yeah. It's like, I was listening to this podcast. It's funny. I was listening to this podcast about how, about movie making. And they were saying that like most people who make movies, it's like, it's such a non-paying thing. Like you like hope to break even if you're like making indie films that mm-hmm. like a lot of them are just like, they have money from another source and they just use it to like, so I think that might be my life is like, I just make money in the stock market. Cause I am really talented with the stock market. So it's like, either like I just do that to make money and then I do this for fun. I don't know, but I'm kind of.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I know your answer sounded a lot more noble because you were like, yeah, I just want to like help people. I'm like, I want to make movies that are funny. And you're like, I want to help the less fortunate. It's like, I want to do that stuff too.
Well, I mean, the things that I'm really thinking about more are, you know, like something involving working with kids because I used to be a camp counselor and that was just so much fun. I just thought kids were so much fun and they're also, you know, generally pretty stupid. So, you know, in that sense, they're no smarter than me. Like, I don't think I could be like a high school teacher. I think like the kids are way smarter than me, but I'm like pretty stupid. So I could probably teach kids or something. No, I'm just joking. I don't know. Or maybe this will just be like a little break that I'm taking from comedy and I'll continue doing it. I've been off social media for a while. And that has been a really interesting thing. Like I've been off for about 4 months and that's been mostly a really good thing. I just have my attention span back and I found myself being able to, I don't know, just focus on things a little bit more and read books.
Yeah,
and
totally. I just watched a TED talk about that, about how like basically people have zero attention span now and because we're just like stimulated all day long.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also think for me, part of it too, is having been at Fallon for 7 years, it's basically like it's feels like a factory or something. I mean, it's like a grind. And I remember thinking when I left the show, I would just kind of jump right into something, but I couldn't do that. I wasn't able to do that. I needed to start going to therapy and I needed to start like meditating. And, you know, I only meditate like 15 minutes a day, basically, but it really helps a little bit, you know, like not a lot, but it helps a little bit. And having time to just clear my mind and read books and try to kind of get back to, I don't know, like find myself again. Because I basically spent 7 years of my life putting Jimmy Fallon, you know, first, sort of, you know, giving my life to that show. And it feels really good to kind of, you know, try to like reclaim my own life, sort of.
Yeah. I remember, like, I mean, I worked for a similar length at Ridiculousness. I was there for 6 years. And
wow.
I remember, so before I got the job, like, all I ever wanted to do was, like, work at a TV show, you know, like, I was just, and I mean, obviously, Ridiculousness wouldn't have been my first choice, but, you know, I remember this guy who already worked for the show before I was going to start working there was kind of like criticizing it and like complaining about it. And I remember thinking like, how can you complain about, I'm like, you get paid what amount of money to do what, you know, to like sit in a room and make jokes. I'm like, holy God, like I would kill for that job. You know, like, I'm like, I would dig ditches for that kind of money. That's crazy. You know? Mm-hmm. And then it was so true. Like, as soon as I got the job, I was just kind of like, ah, you know, it's like,
yeah,
it was like, it's funny how it's like, it's kind of the be careful what you wish for thing. But because I went from being like a stand-up comic who never had to get up early or anything to like basically having a job, you know, it was like my first job.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fun job, but it was still a job, you know, at the end of the day. And I remember thinking, God, am I really doing this for the money? Like, I'm like, do I want to be here? It's like, if it weren't for the money, would I stay? And like, should I make a decision based on money and having all these kind of, you know, it's like so quickly how I went from being like, I would love to have that to just being like, is this really what I want? You know?
Yeah, totally. Like, yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting.
I had that too. I mean, towards the end of my time as a sketch supervising writer at Fallon, I started to notice that for the most part, my job just ended up being kind of answering emails. And a lot of the emails were about sketches and stuff, but it was really more about kind of overseeing sketches. And the actual percent of time I spent really writing comedy towards the end was probably like 5%, 10%. It was very small. And I realized I'm not really doing comedy anymore. Right. I don't know if I really can consider myself.
It's almost like the more successful you become at being a comedy writer, the more likely you are to just end up being like an office manager type, like
yeah, you know? That kind of was the case at the show sometimes, where I think, you know, really good, I did well as a sketch writer, and that was part of the reason that they asked me to be a sketch supervising writer. But then once you're in that position, you're actually kind of doing less original writing overall, but you sort of have more, I guess, creative influence in the show. So it's sort of a weird trade-off, but I don't know. For my money, there's nothing that beats creating, you know, writing and performing your own comedy. Is, you know, that's like, I mean, isn't that why anyone wants to pursue a career in comedy in the first place?
Yeah.
You know, I totally know what you're saying. I mean, in those sorts of dream jobs that you have, you know, the dream is never exactly as you imagine it. And for as much fun as I had at Fallon, it was also, you know, a very stressful job and with just constant challenges all the time and so much that's out of your control, like just pitching ideas, not being sure what's going to get on. And then just honestly, most of everything there is out of your control. And sometimes everything just kind of lines up and works out, which is great. In many ways, it is a dream job, but it also is just very stressful and, you know, challenging. So yeah, I don't know. I guess it just kind of comes down to like, yeah, what do you want to do? You know, which is a hard question to answer.
Yeah. And I think my advice for, because I always get asked about, you know, young people that are trying to like, how do you get to this point or whatever? It's like, I think the almost best thing to do is kind of really think about what is your ultimate goal and then just like reverse engineer it, right? It's like, do you want to be someone who writes for a late night show, or do you want to be someone who makes films, or like, so they're like very different types of things, you know? And it's like for instance, whether like, because working on a show, like a TV show especially, you have to be someone who likes to like work with other people and collaborate and kind of come up with like material that's gonna be short-lived over and over and over and over, you know, like,
yeah,
like you're not perfecting an idea, I would say, for the most part, right? You're kind of like coming up with new material every day if you work for like a
late- I once heard Chris Elliott, who wrote for Letterman, describe his sense of humor as disposable, and he said that that's why he thought he was a good fit for a late night TV, was because his comedy was disposable. And he clarified, he's like, I don't mean that in a bad way, and I'm like, I didn't think of it in a bad way. I actually think disposable is hilarious. I mean, a lot of my favorite Conan bits were things that I would probably call somewhat disposable, but just things where almost the imperfection is sort of part of it, you know?
Right. Yeah, for sure. And I think if you want to do that kind of thing, like you were saying earlier, it makes a lot of sense to just like come out with a TikTok or two every day, or, you know, like an Instagram.
Yeah.
Like, just make, it doesn't have to be perfect. Just come up with some sort of comedy idea every day and get in that mindset of like, even if it's shot in a really shitty way with like, you know, like you don't have to have perfect props, perfect anything.
No.
For comedy, you know, no one cares, you know, so.
No one cares. People will see, if you're funny, people will see that, you know?
Yeah.
I know that a friend of mine just was working on a HBO show called How To with John Wilson. Have you heard of that show?
Mm-mm.
So I think this guy, John Wilson, used to just like take a, you know, regular camera, like out on the streets of New York and just like make his own little mini documentary movies that are kind of sort of like crappy quality. But it got noticed by Nathan Fielder from Nathan For You. Mm-hmm. And so... yeah, it's like my favorite show. So Nathan Fielder and my friend Michael Komen, who co-created Nathan For You and used to write for Conan, they are both like working on this guy's show. His name is John Wilson, and I think he was just a regular dude with a camera, but the stuff he made was hilarious, and now it's its own HBO show basically. But yeah, I mean, you know, like you just have to kind of channel yourself and, you know, try to make it good if you can. But I think more importantly than that, it just try to channel yourself, because you are the only you, so there's no sense in trying to act like a different person, you know. Mm-hmm. Even though the all the instincts are there to do that, because a lot of times what gets people involved in comedy are comedic influences, you know. So you kind of, you know, I mean, I remember like when we were doing stand-up in Boston, I felt like at the time there were a good amount of comedians who were inadvertently channeling Mitch Hedberg or Dane Cook, who were pretty big at the time. Yeah. I probably did that myself for a couple sets. I remember trying one set of just only one-liners, which I normally didn't do, but right. That was probably inspired by Mitch Hedberg.
I definitely started, when I first started, I definitely was... like I even like kind of talked to like Mitch Hedberg a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
My friends would be like, why are you talking like that? And it took me like a year or two of doing stand-up to like realize like, oh, I should just talk like as myself, you know.
Yeah.
Which like seems obvious, but it wasn't, you know.
Yeah, totally. It's scary to do that. It's scary to be like, well, what is, you have to kind of face yourself and be like, who am I, what do I think and believe, because everything essentially comes from your point of view, even if you're not actually making any sort of socio-political points, you know. Yeah. that in itself is your point of view, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I've held you for a long time. I'm looking at the clock. I'm like, wow, this is a long time.
Oh yeah,
time flies when you're having fun. I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show. I hope you help a lot of homeless people.
I hope so too.
And children, to help. And dumb children.
Yeah, dumb children. Yeah.
Like you make me think of that part of There's Something About Mary where he's trying to act like he's a good guy, and he's like, yeah, I work with retards. those goofy little bastards are all we have in this crazy mixed up world. It's like, you're like, yeah, I want to work with kids, those stupid little bastards. I don't know what's good.
They're really very dumb. No, thank you so much, Rob. This was a lot of fun. It was great catching up with you.
Thanks for doing it. All right. Have a good one, Arthur.
You too.
Thank you for listening to Thank You for Joking, a show about the process of being a comedy writer. Sometimes it's stand-up comics going through that process together, trying out jokes, giving each other notes, and sometimes I'm going to have TV writers on here talking about their process. So please subscribe. There'll be new episodes every week. Thanks.